I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Tim Shepelak. Tim is with The Growth Coach. And Tim, you're an executive coach. And we hear a lot about coaching these days. There's, you know, athletic team coaches. What does an executive coach do? What do you try to get someone to do when you're coaching them?
The essence of my job as a coach is to help my clients get to another level of performance and continue to improve their performance so they get better results. And of course, we're talking business results, but as we all know, business and life are very interrelated. So when business gets better, life gets better, doesn't it?
How did you decide to get into this, Tim?
I discovered coaching from a local guy who had a coaching business, and he was considering taking it national. I was at a point in my career where I wanted to get off the road, and everything just lined up very well. So we actually formed a business relationship. He decided to franchise his coaching business and take it national. And I became his first franchisee.
And not only that, you were also named Coach of the Year just a few years ago. Yes. And you were the first franchise owner to be inducted into the Growth Coach Hall of Fame.
That's correct. Thank
so that's
you for
wonderful.
Recognizing that. I appreciate that.
Well, and your system, the Growth Coach system's grown quite a bit since you were, I guess, the first franchisee.
It really has. Yeah. Now the Growth Coach covers about 140 different territories, both in the United States and also some of the other areas like, you know, Canada and Mexico and even Ecuador. They've got a coach down there now.
Well, you had a background as an executive. I mean, you ran businesses and divisions for a large company.
Yes.
Was that helpful in relating to the people that you're coaching?
Absolutely. If you think about the nature of what I'm doing, I'm working with impact players within an organization, which typically translates to the business owner, the key people, key executives, key managers. And so I can bring very practical business understanding and help and be very relevant. Everything I do as a coach, I look at it in two ways. I have to help my clients get a great return on investment from their coaching investment, and I have to help them reduce their risk. And so that speaks very well to the CEO mindset, doesn't it?
Sure does.
What do you mean when you say you have to help them reduce their risk?
Well, if you think about risk, there are a lot of risks we take just being in business, and of course we all have life risk as well. Some of the risk comes from not being totally aware of what's happening around you. So one of the things I see out there is sometimes, you know, business and life kind of forces you down to keep your head down at a more tactical level. And so one of my jobs as a coach is to raise my clients to that strategic level. And I'm talking behaviorally, get them looking up and into the future and looking around and seeing their blind spots and the issues and the opportunities that they should be looking at. So when they're doing the opposite, they're actually taking a lot of risk. There are things coming at them that they might not realize that aren't good.
Do you think they do that because it's comfortable, because that's probably what got them to the position they're in? They're good at executing the day-to-day stuff?
Absolutely. They're comfort zones we fight. We also fight what I call success patterns. So, you know, I'm coaching people who are already successful, but they need to get to their next levels of success. So if you think about it, if I were a batting coach, a hitting coach in baseball, I'm working with a 300 hitter to make them a 350 hitter. But in the back of their mind, they're worried that what we're working on might make them a 250 hitter. So we have to find a way to help them translate the changes that we need to see in a way that they can translate and make it successful for them.
Tim, if folks listening today would like more information about your business, your organization, reach you, what is your contact information?
It's thegrowthcoach.com. And then my particular webpage, you'd put a /T Shepelak, S-H-E-P-E-L-A-K.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Tim Shepelak. Tim is the Growth Coach. He is an executive coach. And Tim, you work with highly successful people who want to be even more successful. And the question that I have in terms of the return on the investment, because
yes,
I think that goes through a lot of successful people's mind.
Yes.
How do you help a business owner or an executive justify the return on the investment?
Absolutely. And we actually consciously work toward a return on investment in the coaching process. And by virtue of the things that we're working on with the executive or business owner, we're getting a return on investment. So some examples would be, I'm working with impact players to begin with. And when you get them to another level of performance, you start getting an immediate return on investment. An example of that would be, a lot of times a business owner or an executive gets too embroiled in the details, the day-to-day, and they ignore the long-term, the more strategic, the things that really make an impact, key customer relationships, that type of thing. So when you can convert time and energy over to those areas, it doesn't take many hours of conversion to get an immediate return on investment that's very, very handsome for them.
I assume you've been doing this for 10 years. I assume you've coached, you know, a fair number of people over that period of time. Is everyone coachable?
You know, I think there are moments in time where any of us might not be coachable. Probably inherently we're all coachable, but there might be times in your life where you're just not open. And that's all I ask my clients for, is just to be open to considering other things, other ways of looking at things, different mindsets, different behaviors. And the nature of my clients, they tend to be very improvement oriented. And so they just naturally have that orientation. So they're open to things like coaching that will improve them.
So if someone listening today who's already successful would like to reach a whole nother level, how do they know how to even go about choosing a coach?
Like many professions, you know, it's unregulated, but one can look for certain things. So for example, I've been in business for 10 years as an executive coach. So there's an experience factor that I think is very important. Certifications are important. I'm certified in two different coaching methodologies. So I'm able to blend and use proven coaching techniques to help my clients discover what's impactful for them. And I think, quite frankly, business experience is very important. I want everything that I do with my client to be relevant to themselves and their business and their life as well. You know, having that background, I can easily relate to my client. I've been in their positions since I've been a CEO. I've worked in various functions. And so I can relate to them and make everything we do as a coach relevant to them.
You just can't separate the business from the rest of your life. And I think a lot of people say, well, I'm going to do this in my day job, but in my world, my day job is my whole life. Do you help people with that as well?
Absolutely. In fact, we go so far as to say you can't separate your business and life and self. It's all interrelated, intertwined. So we work on the whole thing. And if you think about the nature of what I'm doing, I'm working with my clients at a behavioral level. We want to get some of the behavior patterns modified and improved. That doesn't shut off when you choose to go home at night.
This is Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, the experts say that the recession is over and that times are getting good again, which I think is pretty true, except that it still seems that it's difficult for many companies to get additional funding from banks and financial institutions to grow their business.
Well, it's certainly not like it was in 2007 or, you know, pre-recession, and maybe it shouldn't ever be like that again, because I think perhaps it was too easy to get a loan back then. And now maybe the pendulum has still swung too far and it may be too hard. But it is challenging, I think, for a business to get a loan these days if they don't already have a good relationship with their bank.
Well, I think to your point that it's still very fresh on bankers' minds in terms of the recession and how some loans that they probably were very responsible in obtaining went sour. And so until those kinds of memories are pushed out of their minds, it's going to be challenging for many businesses to get bank financing.
One of the keys, I think, is finding the bank that's a good fit for you. I mean, not all banks want all types of loans, all types of industries. In fact, they may not want to do business in your particular industry, or they may have already enough clients in that industry and they want to diversify their portfolio. So the first thing I think you have to do when you're talking to a bank is try to vet whether your type of business is a good fit for them, your size business is a good fit.
That's true. Many banks don't want to have anything to do really in terms of financing startups or early stage companies. So if that's the case, you should just know that going into the conversation so that you may need to readjust how you plan on raising additional funds to run your business. Other banks may not want to make loans to real estate professionals. Again, if you know that, you can realign your thinking in terms of how you're going to get money to fund your growth.
Yeah, and I think if you haven't shopped for loans in a while, one thing you'll realize is in most cases, you'll have to guarantee the debt if you're a small business owner.
You know, it's so funny because many people just can't get that. They can't get over the hurdle that a banker would want them to guarantee the debt. And I find that fascinating because what's happening is as a business owner, you're going to that bank and you're saying, hey, bet on me, invest in me, take a chance with me. And the banker's saying, wait a minute, you're not even willing to guarantee your own debt. You don't have enough faith in yourself and your company. So I think the days of no guaranteed loans, except in a very few instances, are over. You're going to have to guarantee that debt.
Yeah, unless you have a substantial net worth and cash flow from your business. You know, the other important thing I think, or one other important thing when you're looking for financing, is to make sure that all your ducks are in a row, that your financial records are in good order, that you've got a forecast of what your business is going to do, that you have a plan for what you're going to do with the money and how you're going to pay it back.
And you need to go into the conversation with the banker as if you have really done your due diligence and your homework and do have your plans in place. You do have your financial house in order. Make them understand that you've thought this through thoroughly, that you understand completely how the loan proceeds are going to help grow your business. Because you know what? A banker does not want to fund a loss. They want those loan proceeds to be going to benefit your company so ultimately you can generate cash flow to pay them back. The most critical part of your overall financial planning is your financial forecast. It's wonderful that you have been historically profitable, which clearly is going to be a requirement that you have shown some level of profits. But bottom line is the banker is betting on you going into the future. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, we've talked about this subject before, but I think it's critical for people to hear it again, and that is how to better save money.
And most people have not saved enough money.
You know, you just can't hope and pray that things are going to work out. I'm a real believer in having a plan, and not just a plan that's a thought in your mind. It's got to be a plan that's written down on paper, because until it is written down, it's just an idea. So people should truly take the time, make a plan on how they're going to achieve enough of a savings so that they can accomplish whatever it is they're trying to do, whether it's to fund their child's college education, which we know is quite expensive these days, fund their retirement. Whatever it is, you need a plan.
You know, Crystal, I saw a statistic recently that said that only 65% of the people who are able to participate in a work-related retirement program participate at all. So one out of every three people doesn't even participate in the program, which almost all of them provide some benefits from the employer's perspective besides allowing you a deductible contribution. And of the 65% that do participate, many of them don't contribute enough.
It has to be a conscientious habit for you to save money. And I use the word habit very intentionally, because it should just be something that occurs after a while without any thought. And the only way to make that happen is to really set yourself up for success. Take money directly out of your paycheck every month and save it. Contribute to your employer's retirement plan at work. And certainly, my goodness, contribute enough to at least take advantage of the employer's match. Because if you are not doing that, you are leaving money on the table. It's just like saying no to a raise.
Well, and if you have high cost debt, for example, credit card debt, which oftentimes is 16% or more, then you should pay that off as quickly as possible and make sure you don't incur any more.
Saving for emergencies is also a very important habit, because what happens is when that emergency occurs and you don't have any immediate cash available, then you're going to immediately jump into debt. And it could take a long time before you pay that off.
Or even worse, you don't pay your bills. Maybe you skip a mortgage payment because you had to fund the whatever the emergency was. And then all of a sudden, you have a horrible credit rating. You can't get credit. Some people have ended up losing their house. It's important to build an emergency fund. And it's a fund that you build before that emergency occurs. Hopefully it never will. But if it does, you need to have a fund so that you're not borrowing at an exorbitant rate.
An easy way to save money is through, again, the direct withdrawal, direct deposit coming out of your paycheck into a savings account, a mutual fund, a savings bond, whatever it is, just having it come directly out of your account so that you never see it hit your checking account. And when you get a raise, take that entire raise, or the big majority of it, and save that. That's money that you haven't been using, and it's an easy way to start a program of saving.
Anything that you can do that requires no further action, such as an automatic savings or an automatic transfer program, is going to accomplish a lot more goals than if you have to take a step to actually save the money, or you have to wait and see how much is left over before you make a deposit into savings.
Probably the largest asset that most of us have is our home, the equity in our home. And it's just critical that you pay off your home mortgage before you retire. That is a very important thing to do for most people, because that's usually a pretty big payment. And when you can make your last mortgage payment before you retire, that's going to generate much more cash flow for you to be able to use through retirement. So again, create a plan that's going to allow you to pay off your debt, whether it be your credit card debt, but just as importantly and more importantly, your home mortgage debt. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Schweitzer. Dr. Schweitzer is a chiropractor, but he's also serving as Campbell County's coroner. And in my world, I really can't think of one person that I know right now who is addicted to drugs, specifically heroin. From what I understand, that may not actually be true. I may know someone who I just don't realize is using heroin.
It is without a doubt that there is somebody that you know that has an addiction either to heroin or a prescription drug or other types of substance. And if you don't know them personally or professionally, you will interact with someone today in your normal routine that likely has such an addiction.
You know, we used to hear about heroin 30 years ago as a problem in sort of inner city places, large cities. But more recently, it seems like we hear about it a lot. And it's not in the inner city. It's out in the suburbs, isn't it?
It is. And that's by design. The various people that are promoting this scourge on our society are particularly targeting educated, functional people who we don't typically think are the at-risk population for such a problem.
So it's really potentially people that we work with every day, or family, friends, children of people that we work with. This has a huge impact on all of us, including our businesses.
It destroys families. It destroys communities. It is the reach that it has within our community is greater and greater. And I recognize every day not only the financial impact, but the overall devastating effect it has on our businesses, our communities, and our families.
Well, and you have a pretty staggering statistic about your own personal experience as coroner with heroin overdoses. What were those numbers?
In my first 12 years as coroner, we identified 5 deaths that were a direct result of heroin overdose. Last year alone, we had 38. So the numbers are staggering.
What is giving rise to this increased usage of heroin?
There are a number of factors that go probably beyond my level of expertise, but one significant factor is we have a population of people that are getting dependent on prescription drugs, and there seems to be a segue between people either not getting access to those medications or the affordability of them is beyond their reach, and they're resorting to a drug that hasn't been around in much popularity for quite some time that gives them the same desired effect as their prescription opiates.
But you would think that heroin would be more expensive than a prescription drug.
You know, that probably has varied over time, but most people suggest that the access is easier and the cost is less to get heroin now than some sort of individual opiate-based prescription drug.
Do you think the problem is there's just too many painkillers that are being prescribed?
Well, I have to be careful with the hats that I wear. If anybody knows a little bit about what a chiropractor is, or a doctor of chiropractic, or a chiropractic physician is, our entire career is focused on giving people an alternative to drugs and surgeries. So I have my own individual personal and professional biases. But I do remember, even when I was younger, that you didn't seem to get things like morphine and fentanyl and some of these stronger pain control unless you were actually hospitalized or you were at home in hospice care with some terminal diseases. But it seems like routinely I see people receiving prescriptions for when they're ambulatory out in society, and things you just didn't see, I think, at one time.
And if folks listening would like information about you, Dr. Schweitzer, what is your contact information?
Well, I can be contacted through the Campbell County Fiscal Court, through their website. My office number is published. I'm in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, right across from St. Elizabeth Hospital. If it's an emergency, they can contact me through County Dispatch.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Schweitzer. Dr. Schweitzer is a chiropractor here in Kentucky, but he's also the coroner here in Campbell County. And you know, Dr. Schweitzer, just the other day I was picking up the daily paper and I saw a big article right on the front page of a mother with a young adult child who was addicted to heroin. And it just seems like we're hearing that more and more. And I guess my question to you is there a certain demographic in terms of age? Is it young adults that tend to be more susceptible to this? I know it's not economic status, because middle income, even higher income people also can be addicted to heroin and are using that. What's your take on this?
It does cross all socioeconomic barriers. It does cross into the older population, the middle-aged population. Everybody's at risk. I'd suggest that there's strong evidence that it is being targeted toward a group of individuals that we typically didn't think were at risk. The middle-class Americans, well-educated, living in communities, very functional with families.
The adults of these families or the kids of the families?
Both. Its effects impact them at their workplace. Cities are going losing a lot of money trying to deal with this problem.
It can affect a business if you have an employee who you think's an honest, bona fide employee and they have a drug addiction. They'll probably do anything to feed that addiction, including stealing from the company.
Statistically, I was at a public forum just last week, and a drug task officer there confirmed that 70 to 80% of all burglaries, robberies, and home invasions now are due to heroin alone.
When someone has a huge addiction or a real problem, they need the money, they can justify why it's okay to, quote, borrow, in essence, steal from the company to be able to support that. And what are your thoughts in terms of what we could do to rally around this issue to minimize this?
Someone who's addicted to something such as heroin, the addiction just overwhelms them. They'll even rob from their grandmother and routinely steal from family members. So it'd be expected that employers would also be at risk for this as well. Nothing would be out of bounds for someone that's got this strong of an addiction. To deal with this problem, it's ultra complicated. It's going to take efforts both by prescription pharmaceutical companies recognizing that they are, in fact, a segue to the abuse of such illegal or illicit drugs. It's going to take efforts by our communities, the leaders in our communities, and a willingness to open and discuss this openly amongst us and not turn our backs to it, because there isn't a person out there listening to this that won't encounter somebody who either has a family member or they themselves is faced with a heroin addiction problem. They're out there working every day in our downtowns, in our suburbs, and we can no longer turn away from it.
Well, and you've seen this firsthand in your role as a coroner, because some of those people end up dead, right, from overdose.
Absolutely. I handle anywhere from, and they'd come in trends, but I handle anywhere from 4 to 8 heroin deaths in a calendar month. Those numbers are quite staggering when compared to where I was back in the late 90s and, you know, over 10 years ago, where we didn't have that many heroin deaths at all.
You know, Dr. Schweitzer, in addition to being a coroner, you're also a chiropractor. Let's talk about that a bit. And how did you choose that field?
Chiropractors tend to run in families. My dad was a chiropractor. He was a second generation. So I'm a third generation chiropractor in an office that's been open for over 75 years. Not a lot of people grow up and say, I want to be a policeman, a CPA, a fireman, and a chiropractor. It tends to run in families.
If folks like to get more of that information, what's your website?
You can access me through the Campbell County Fiscal Court, the same place you would get a hold of your county attorney or anything else. And my number is also published in the...
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Tom Hortell, and Tom is the Chief Technical Officer and founder of a company named High Five Innovation. And Tom, innovation is such a buzzword, but is innovation something that could be taught, or are you just born innovative?
Innovation is really about curiosity, always wanting to know why things work and how they work, and wanting to being able to deconstruct problems. It is something that I feel I was born with, because even at the age of 6, I was taking things apart in our house. And I actually attribute a lot of my creativity to the fact that I grew up in Appalachia. When something broke, you didn't go out and buy something new. You had to take it apart and learn how to fix it. So, yeah, I had a BB gun and a bucket of soldiers, and I could entertain myself for days. People used to tell me, you know, you got a lot of Yankee ingenuity in you. And I'd say, well, but I'm not a Yankee. You know? So we called it Appalachian innovation. It's Yankee ingenuity with a side of grits.
Well, now you have another project that's called Open Innovation. So what's that all about?
Open Innovation evolved within Procter & Gamble. I spent 23 years at Procter & Gamble as a technologist. I had some very successful projects, and I eventually became an innovation trainer within P&G and helped to develop a lot of the training methodologies for innovation that are still in place today. We created a group called Visioneering that was part of the Emerging Technologies group, and we would work with project teams to help them deconstruct their problems, to analyze what the issues were, and then help them to find new solutions that would help to drive them forward.
Well, what are some of the challenges with adopting open innovation?
Open innovation requires a lot of collaboration and patience and a certain level of trust between the team members. And I think the different parties within a team can often have very different objectives in mind. And of course, your goal is to create win-win solutions for everybody. You also can expect a lot of what I call science friction, you know, where people are kind of vying to get credit for pieces of the project.
You know, Tom, it seems like as a society, we kind of were born here in this country, at least, on innovation. We had to be innovative, right? But now society has kind of moved to where people got comfortable being, quote, an employee, just doing what somebody else told them. Do you see, because of the recession, because of maybe some things that's happened in the economy, do you see an emphasis back on innovation again, maybe on people who would otherwise not have had the courage to invent something, now coming and actually trying out new and different things?
There's different levels of innovation that you can get into. Everybody seems to want innovation, but it's really determined by how much risk you're willing to take. A lot of people opt for what I call incremental innovation, where you're just really kind of taking the next obvious step in the process and you're growing a little bit. But then you can kind of step it up a little bit to a systematic innovation, or then you can move up to a disruptive innovation where you're really kind of starting to change the rules. But I actually like breakthrough innovation, which is where you really just, you change all the rules. Swiffer WetJet was a breakthrough innovation because people don't mop their floors anymore. They Swiffer their floors.
What about the Inventors Council? I know you're also involved with that. What if people are interested in learning about that and learning about innovation, getting involved with the Inventors Council, how can they do that?
Yes, the Inventors Council in Cincinnati has been around for about 25 years now, and we are a nonprofit. It's an all-volunteer organization, and we're out there to help the small inventors of the world.
And if folks would like to learn about that, what's the contact information?
You can go to inventcincy.com.
Thank you so much for being our guest, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Ashley Hess. Ashley is a partner with the law firm of Baker & Hostetler, and you're the president of the Association for Corporate Growth, which is an organization that helps companies with mergers and acquisitions and that type of thing. But you also do that in your law practice as well, don't you?
That's right. I have a middle market corporate and mergers and acquisitions legal practice at Baker & Hostetler.
So basically, you advise clients when they're involved in either buying or selling a business or a division?
That's right. And a lot of the work that I do is on the front end to get these businesses prepared for that process. And sometimes that can take as long as a year. And you also make introductions for them to investment bankers and other advisors who are going to help them through that process. And on the back end, in other words, once they sell a company, a lot of these people need estate planning and other advisors to come in and help so they can do tax planning and other planning that they need to do for their lives.
Do you work with clients too who might be anticipating selling their business in, say, 3 years, 5 years, to help them understand what they need to do in terms of contracts, legal issues, so they're in the best position to sell in the future?
We absolutely do. The gamut runs from everything from doing environmental work, where we may have a phase one done so that we understand any issues that are, you know, have occurred in any of the real property owned by a client, cleaning up their contracts, and just identifying what could be an issue. And the example I always use is the selling the house or selling the car example, which is if you're going to sell your house, you do some touch-up painting, you make sure everything looks right, so that when people come through the house, they don't have to ask all the questions or do the digging on their own. And that's the way it should work when you're going to sell your business.
What are maybe some of the mistakes you've seen people do when they're selling a business? You know, things that you should avoid or at least do something proactively to avoid?
Many times it's too late if a client calls you and they've already signed a letter of intent, or they've already basically reached an agreement to sell their business and they've locked in place a purchase price, and perhaps they haven't adequately addressed issues that are going to be negotiated after that letter of intent is signed that will ultimately drive down the purchase price or what the client is able to put in their pocket. You know, other issues that come up is that clients sometimes don't think about the estate planning issues that go into the sale of a business. And if you could do some pre-planning, you could save a lot of
millions
money.
Sometimes.
Absolutely, you can with proper planning.
People are usually only going to enter into a transaction once. So you want to make sure that if you sell your business, that you're doing it the right way. There's no dress rehearsal here.
That's right. It's absolutely right. And as I tell clients all the time, most of the work that I do, you won't even see. But if we don't do it, you'll feel it. And that is, I think, the best way to explain it, that with the proper planning and working through this the right way, it's going to be an extremely smooth process.
Well, and if you're selling your business, in all likelihood, the buyer has been through other transactions. So they're going to be pretty sophisticated. So you need to make sure that you get some pretty sophisticated advice.
That's absolutely right.
Are you seeing an uptick in M&A work, Ashley? Because for a while, it just seemed like things were dead.
We are seeing an uptick in M&A work. What we are seeing, though, is an uneven market, and you are seeing larger companies get involved in M&A. You are seeing less sell-side work on the lower end of the middle market, and I think in the coming years, you'll see more of that pick up.
Ashley, if folks would like more information about you, about Baker Hostetler, what's your contact information?
You can find us on the internet at www.bakerlaw.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Peggy Shannon. Peggy is the founder of Queen City Cookies. And Peggy, you've got a very fascinating story. Let's talk about how you came up with the idea of Queen City Cookies and why you founded that company.
I think love of our great community and seeing what you can do and making a difference when you're committed to making a difference. In 2008, you probably remember there was the big swimming pool going on. Were we going to be able to fund them? And then the same story in 2009. And I heard one too many news broadcasts about how the budget cuts were going to potentially close the swimming pools. They ended up not doing it, thank heavens. But I decided right then that I was tired of that being part of the conversation of our lives, and that while nobody needs another company who produces cookies or any baked goods, there certainly is a need in society for a company that is committed to making a difference. So,
you know, I love this saying about living to give, just live to give. And the fact that you basically have used your business is an opportunity to have a purpose surrounding that. So purpose-driven organization, I love that.
We've been very successful, and we've, I think, made a difference in such a short amount of time. We're just 2 years old, and first year out, we started the Queen City Cookies Art Camp, which is a fabulous opportunity for kids in the Northside neighborhood, but we've expanded. I think we started with 25 kids. We're up to about 150 kids now a week, and we have free art activities in the park. Happen Inc., if you don't know Happen Inc., they're fabulous. And Northside, they provide free art activities for kids. And then we feed them dinner for the families and the children
that
each week.
That is so wonderful. On the cookies, did you always grow up wanting to bake?
It's interesting. People either fall into two, maybe three camps, not bakers or chefs at all, or the chefs or bakers. And I always was a baker. I actually started baking, I think, in like so many little kids with an Easy Bake Oven.
I was going to say, I even burnt my Easy Bake Oven cakes.
Oh, that's pretty hard. Yeah. But I actually, it was very funny. I won 2 years in a row for pound cake, and I don't remember what the second was, the state fair when I think I was in fourth grade.
So are these your own recipes?
A lot of them are. We've come up, we have a pretty diverse line. We're a boutique bakery, which means that you're going to find something a little bit different than you would if you went to a more traditional bakery. We have a complete line of little bite-sized cookies, and those are my recipes, and those are four very distinct, wonderful little bites of joy. There's a really rich, buttery shortbread, a chocolate chipotle, which has a kick of fire at the end, an award winner. It was won second place Outstanding Cookie of the Year last year by the Fancy Food Show, which is like getting nominated for an Oscar in the food industry. Rosemary Sesame, which is more savory, goes great with wine and cheese, and then Blueberry Maple. And then, of course, we have Schnecken, which is off the charts and has won multiple awards and been in Oprah this last month.
So you started your basement just a couple of years ago, and now you've recently expanded to four buildings?
Four buildings, yeah, it's crazy. Well, we went from the basement, which was teeny, teeny, tiny, a commercial kitchen, but it was still pretty tiny, to the carriage house on my property. And so we had been looking for about a year to buy a property. I was very committed to staying in Northside, and so we bought an old church complex.
And if people would like more information about Queen City Cookies or where they can buy them, what's the contact information?
Well, queencitycookies.com is our website, and our phone number is 513-591-0022.
Can you buy them in the stores?
All over.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Peggy Shannon. Peggy is the founder of Queen City Cookies, and I love this business because it's truly a business that it's a purpose-driven business. You do this in large part because you want to support various charities and nonprofits.
Yes, and that's really the reason that we started the company and what gets me out of bed in the morning. It's really exciting. I just actually came up with a new idea last week that we could partner with different nonprofits and co-brand the cookies and charge a little bit more money for them, but then all of that money goes directly to that charity.
That is amazing.
I think one of the things that's sad to me is that people feel discouraged that because of their financial situation that they might not be able to contribute to society in a way that they'd like to. But even if you just sit down and read to kids at a school, or there's lots of tutoring opportunities, Wordplay. I don't know if you know Wordplay.
Sure,
in Northside, they have a tutoring program for kids at risk, and they're always looking for tutors and treat their tutors quite well. So it's a great way to give back.
You know, even when we started our nonprofit called Accounting for Kids, I think to the extent that the adults can just be with the children for a little while and see what a little bit of time with the child can really do. And what you're doing is just remarkable. And what you are doing is you're making these amazing cookies. It's been featured on show like Oprah. You've been on the Wall Street Journal. You've been on Real Simple.
Yeah, that not the cookies so much, the Schnecken. Yeah, the Schnecken is, we like to refer to it lovingly, of course, as crack in a box. And I always joke that people need to maybe check into a 12-step group. It's really that good.
And you've come up with something called Bacon Schnecken.
Bacon Schnecken actually was nominated by the Fancy Food Show for Outstanding New Product of the Year last year, and which
it's
is kind of like winning the Oscar, or being nominated for an Oscar.
And what's this amazing cookie that you had called Rosemary Sesame Shortbread?
It
sounds decadent.
Decadent. It's more designed for wine and cheese,
okay,
and having friends over and having something that you want a little bit of sweetness, but not too much.
So you started your business about 2 years ago in your basement. You've obviously grown, but you started during a time when many people were afraid to certainly go out and take a risk and start a new business. How did that happen?
Well, you know, in 2008 and 2009, you may remember back then the city was having budget problems and the ongoing conversation about where the swimming pool is going to close. I wanted to do something to make sure we didn't continue to have those conversations.
But you came out right when the rest of the economy or people were concerned about the economy.
I think when I'm motivated to move, I move.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I don't really think
what tips would you have
it
for then someone who's listening today who maybe has this in inner desire to do something, help someone start a business? What tips do you have?
I think three things. There's never the perfect time. And if you want to do it, do it. There's never going to be, you know, a lot of people will say, well, when I retire, or when I get enough money, or when I fill in the blank. That's just an excuse to keep you from moving forward. So if you really are committed to doing it, I would do it. But I think also one thing that's really important, and I am so sad to see so many people fail with small business, is you need to have enough money. And they need more money than they ever think they'll need.
If people want to buy your cookies or find out more about Queen City Cookies, where can they get that information?
QueenCityCookies.com. Our phone number, of course, is 513-591-0022.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate.